Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We start with another black eye for Michigan State University. Just days ago, prosecutors accused William Strample, the former dean of the College of Osteopathic Medicine, of using practice medical exams for his own sexual pleasure. Strample supervised Larry Nassar, the now imprisoned physician who abused hundreds of girls and women when he was supposed to be treating them at MSU and USA Gymnastics. A note, the next 3 minutes may contain material that is not suitable for young listeners. Let's check in now with Capitol correspondent and former prosecutor Shayna Roth. Hello, Shayna.
Hi, Reginald.
First, how did we learn about these new details?
Well, we learned about these from a filing that the Attorney General's office did, and it's sort of a long, complicated name. But really what they're saying is that they have these witnesses that are going to present evidence that they think is really going to boost their case. It's going to prove to the court and to jurors that William Strample did not act, that he wasn't mistaken when he did the things that the actual charged witnesses are going to, or victims are going to talk about, and also that he had this sort of intent behind it. And we found out about all of these new details or these new alleged actions that Strample did through this motion and this brief and then the attached police reports in the court documents.
In one case, a woman recounted being the subject of a clinical skills model. What is that and what happened?
What happened is Strample approached her, said, I will give you $100 a session to do this sort of clinical skills modeling. And he brought students in and he had her, I guess, lay down on some sort of a table while she was naked. And then he continued to perform pretty invasive exams on her. And I think the idea is that, or the thinking behind it was that, you know, he is showing these students, you know, this is how you perform, you know, the proper vaginal exam or breast exam. But later on, what happened is this woman explains that Strample would tell her that while he was doing these exams, that it excited him. He also took her out for dinner, just the two of them after these exams. So when he started to tell her that, you know, to make these inappropriate remarks and saying that he was turned on by these exams, that's when she cut off the contact.
What is the status of William Strample's case as of now?
So right now, it's still in district court. This kind of delays some of things a little bit, or could potentially delay things a little bit. The Attorney General's office and the defense attorneys are scheduled to go in front of the judge and talk about this request by the Attorney General's office in May, early May. And so at that time, the judge is going to decide whether or not these women can come in and testify during the preliminary hearing. And the preliminary hearing is sort of this district court mini trial where the judge will then decide if there is enough evidence to send the case up to circuit court for the real full-blown trial. And that preliminary hearing is now scheduled for June.
Thank you, Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we appreciate you staying on top of this story for us. You're listening to Current State from WKAR. As part of the fallout from the Larry Nassar scandal, more than 30 bills are being debated in the Michigan legislature, but they're not exactly sailing through as many of Nassar's survivors had hoped. Tracking the bills is Riley Began, political reporter for Bridge Magazine, and she joins me in studio now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we can't go through all 30 bills and their status right now, but so far, tell me a few of the bills regarding sexual assault that have been heard in committee.
So some of the things that have come up already are bills that would regulate the medical profession. There are some more stringent laws about record keeping and parental consent. There are bills that would expand who can make victim impact statements, bills that would expand sex ed requirements, and bills that would introduce other bad act evidence, which essentially makes it easier for jurors to hear about relevant prior accusations against a defendant, whether or not they were actually charged.
And we know one bill that has hit a roadblock is extending the statute of limitations. So where does that stand and what is in that bill and where is the opposition coming from?
Yeah, so there are actually three bills that would expand the statute of limitations, and those are Senate bills. They all do slightly different things. So they would expand the statute of limitations specifically for people who are assaulted as minors. That's kind of the overarching thing. I wouldn't necessarily call a roadblock because they ask or they easily pass through the Senate. They're waiting to be heard by the House committee. And if it makes it through committee, then it will go to the House and then to the governor. The concern about this bill is with due process. So the opposition so far has come from the ACLU of Michigan, which submitted testimony saying that removing the statute of limitations limits people's ability to defend themselves. Because the later a case is brought, the harder it is to find defensive evidence. Legal experts I talked to agreed that that's a concern. The flip side, though, was that, you know, because of trauma, assault victims often take a long time to come forward. And this sort of law would better accommodate that.
And we saw during the Nassar case, you know, a lot of these young women were violated when they were in their teen years and may have not even recognized that until they were adults and hearing other cases. So we'll see how that goes. What do you think will happen to see the bills move further in both the House or the Senate?
The experts that I talked to pretty much guaranteed that these bills, you know, in one way or another, in some form, are going to pass. And a big reason for that is that there are a huge number of representatives that are up for re-election this year. And this story just has taken on a momentum of its own in such a way that they're really incentivized to vote for whatever comes out of committee. But that's why legal experts and advocacy organizations have been pretty supportive of this longer process that the House is taking. They have done 2 weeks of committee hearings, and they have two more weeks at least, the clerk told me this morning. So we're not sure when they will pass, but they probably will at some point.
So the pressure's on, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for talking with us, Riley Began, political reporter with Bridge Magazine.
Thank you.
And she was talking with us about more than 30 bills being debated at the state capitol following the Larry Nassar sex abuse case. You're listening to Current State from WKAR. It appears the question of legalizing marijuana in Michigan is headed to the November ballot. As we hear from Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta, a state elections board has certified the campaign has enough petition signatures to take the next step.
The next step is to put the question to the legislature, which has 40 days to approve it or it goes on the ballot. The Republican State House Speaker says a vote in the legislature won't happen. Jeff Hank of the group Am I Legalized says that's fine.
We look forward to winning in November. Same time, it'd be great if the legislature adopted it as is and started this already. I mean, cannabis prohibition should be over today, not tomorrow, today.
Polls show wide support for legalizing marijuana in Michigan. A group opposing the measure says it may go to court to block the proposal because marijuana remains illegal under federal law. I'm Rick Pluta at the state capitol.
We hurt in our city, but we will not stop fighting.
That's right.
No. That's why we're here. No justice.
No peace.
That was Flint resident Lila McKeague Harvey, who along with 100 other demonstrators marched in downtown Lansing last Wednesday. That was 4 years to the day since the city's water switched to the Flint River, without lead corrosion controls, prompting pipes to corrode and citizens to drink, cook, and bathe in lead-tainted water. The anniversary comes just weeks after the state of Michigan decided to stop providing bottled water to Flint, which has angered residents and the city's mayor, who talked with WKAR's Carell Vega.
Now Flint Mayor Karen Weaver is fighting back. Mayor Weaver joins me via phone to talk about the latest developments in the city of Flint. Mayor Weaver, thanks for joining me.
Certainly.
What is the status of the lawsuit against Governor Snyder to bring free bottled water back to Flint?
Well, you know, one of the things I've always said is this lawsuit is about more than bottled water. That's just one, that was what got things going, actually. And I'll be sitting down with our attorneys this week to continue that conversation, because the other things we've talked about are we've had more damage. You know, people's fixtures have been damaged. People's in-home plumbing is damaged. Hot water heaters have been damaged. We've talked about the reputation to the city. We've talked about property taxes having gone down during that time. We've talked about civil litigation, and the list goes on. So it's about more than just bottled water.
So all of those factors are going to be part of the lawsuit that will develop.
Those are the conversations that we are having with the attorneys, yes.
Would you say that Flint is still in a water crisis?
you know, for some people, we are still in a water crisis. And I heard saying, you know, that we're not moving fast enough. We're ahead of schedule. We've always said this was a 3-year process. This is year two. We're just starting year two. So we've been clear that it was going to take 3 years to replace all of the lead service lines right from the beginning, and that has never changed. And we're actually ahead of schedule. Out of 9,000 pipes that have been looked at so far, we've changed a little bit over 6,200, and those other 3,000-something were copper to copper. So we're ahead of schedule, and hopefully we can finish sooner than those 3 years. You know, we started back last week.
And what has been the community response to the end of this free bottled water?
Well, you know, there's been outrage about the end of this bottled water. And one of the things that, you know, I recognize, people recognize that our water has tested good. We want our water to test good. And I've always said I would look like an idiot having sat in office for 2.5 years and our water isn't better. Our concern is we still have people whose homes, whose pipes have not been changed. We've got construction going on all across the city. Our last conversation with EPA said nothing had changed, and when you have that amount of construction going in, lead particulates break off from those old service lines and can get into the system. And so it's still a public health issue. So if you haven't had your pipes changed or you have that in-home damage going on, there's a concern. And that's why bottled water is important. The other thing is, while 90% of the results have come back good, we're talking about our school, where our children are, you know, our most valuable resource, our children. And so that's not good enough for our kids when we have schools that are still testing extremely high. That is a problem.
I'm speaking with Flint Mayor Karen Weaver about the state of Michigan ending the distribution of free bottled water in Flint. Mayor Weaver, because Snyder's administration says it's okay, that makes me wonder, personally, are you drinking water from your tap?
I use filtered water and bottled water. You know, like I said, we've got construction going on where I live. It's going on all over the city. And until we get through this, you know, we want to put health over everything, because that's what didn't happen before.
Earlier this week, protesters were ejected from the site of Nestle's Ice Mountain Water Bottling Plant in Stanwood by Mecosta County deputies. How do you feel about the DEQ's decision to allow Nestle to pump more water from the state?
You know, that's something else that we have been outraged about, when we're thinking, you know what, we're almost through this. We could see the finish line coming. We're almost through this lead service line replacement, and to stop bottled water and to do this with Nestle, it's like another slap in the face, and the community is really up in arms about that.
If right now you could be at the top of the Capitol steps in Lansing and every Michigan lawmaker had to listen to you, just look at you and listen to you, what would you tell them?
I'd tell them that they need to make sure Flint is taken care of, because Flint didn't get themselves in this situation, and we still need and deserve finances and support to get us out of it, because the state had such a strong hand in putting us there. I would also let them know about what's happening with us in the economic development arena, but I'd make sure they were paying attention to Flint, because Flint represents other communities around this state and around this country, and all eyes are on us. And what happened in Flint could so easily happen to another community right here in Michigan because of our aging infrastructure. There are so many things that have been taken to make urban communities strong, and we've got to look at that, and we've got to fix it.
That was Flint Mayor Karen Weaver talking about the latest developments in the city of Flint. Mayor Weaver, thank you for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. I do appreciate it as well.
For WKAR News, I'm Karel Vega.
Just ahead.
To be told that you can't do your job simply because of the color of your skin, not because of your performance, is very humiliating.
A Michigan lawsuit over white patients banning non-white caregivers. Plus, grade school literacy is less of a challenge in Livingston County. Education reporter Kevin Lavery takes us there to tell us what's working in the classroom. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. A headline that caught our eye this week is a lawsuit filed by six certified nursing assistants against a Michigan rehab center for discrimination. The women alleged Providence Healthcare and Rehabilitation Center in Zeeland complied with patients who only wanted care from white-only caregivers. Attorney Julie Gafke represents the six black nursing assistants and joins me via Skype. Welcome, Julie.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
So first, how were your clients notified that their race determined which patients they cared for?
The certified nursing assistants who are African-American would be switched with white employees who would care for the patient or resident instead. And it would be indicated to my clients that the patient had requested to be cared for by only white employees. My clients were also told at times not to care for certain patients who had requested white-only care. And my clients were also told that there were patients who had in their care plan that they did not want African-Americans.
What was your client's reaction to learning that news when they were on the job?
Well, it wasn't just once. This has repeatedly been happening to these six plaintiffs throughout the time that they were employed at Providence Healthcare and Rehabilitation Center in Zeeland. And understandably, it was shock, upset, embarrassment, humiliation, just a horrible sense of being discriminated against, being segregated from and treated differently than their white coworkers. I mean, it's a horrible thing to have to experience in the workplace. These certified nursing assistants have hard jobs. They have to bathe, dress, assist elderly individuals or people who have medical conditions and are unable to walk for themselves, for instance. And, you know, at times it can be very challenging to be a caregiver. And so on top of that, to be told that you can't do your job simply because of the color of your skin, not because of your performance, is very humiliating. It's very upsetting.
And we need to mention Providence Life Services spokeswoman Sheila King declined to comment on the litigation with the Associated Press, but said Providence does not change staff assignments based on race. Back to Julie, what do you say to people who say, if that's what the patient wants, that's what they should get, even if it means worse health care?
That patient should be told, listen, we're not going to provide you care based on race. And if you're here to get care, you may get care from somebody who's African-American, who's white, who's Hispanic. We don't assign people based on ethnicity or race. And if you don't like that, then you need to choose a different location, or you need to get home care and have your family care for you. So that's what I would say to the facility. The facility needs to take that position. You know, patients make unreasonable requests all the time. You know, maybe they want to play music really loud. Maybe they want to sexually harass the caregiver. Maybe they want to physically assault the caregiver. Those things are not permissible. So why is it that race discrimination should be permissible?
With your clients in filing the suit, what are they seeking? Just change, or is there a certain dollar amount?
They're seeking both of those things. So change is the most important thing to these plaintiffs. They don't want to see this happen to any employee, to be assigned or segregated based on race. And they also are seeking compensation for the humiliation, the embarrassment, their emotional distress that they endured as a result of this discrimination.
We've been speaking via Skype with Julie Gafke. She represents six black nursing assistants suing Providence Healthcare and Rehabilitation Center in Zeeland for complying with patients who only wanted care from white-only caregivers. Thank you, Julie, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now we're switching to our ongoing series on education in Michigan. Last week, we reported on the release of the 2018 Kids Count Data Book, a comprehensive study of the factors that contribute to the overall well-being of Michigan's children. This year, Livingston County earned the top spot among the state's 83 counties. Ingham County ranks in the middle. One of the most important aspects of a child's quality of life is education. WKAR education reporter Kevin Lavery visited schools in both counties to see how each is teaching literacy skills to some of their youngest learners.
At Challenger Elementary in Howell, a room full of kindergartners is hard at work learning about the weather.
Do rainbows?
You can do rainbows on your umbrella, you're right.
They're not quite ready for dew points and barometric pressure. For now, they're coloring vibrant paper rainbows and writing their thoughts about spring. Melissa Richards circles the room and smiles. She's in a profession that requires her to plan like an adult, to think like a child.
I think that kind of draws why teachers want to be teachers.
Richard is a literacy specialist at Challenger. These are just some of the students she assesses three times each year to check that their skills remain sharp. In the early grades, she starts them off with word sounds and syllables. Richard calls these exercises things you can do in the dark.
With kindergarten, a typical lesson at the beginning of the year might focus just on rhyme. Can they rhyme? Can they hear rhyming? Can they produce rhyming? And then going down the scope of phonological awareness.
Some of these kindergartners may have been first exposed to these skills in preschool, but it's a good bet that most were not. Though Livingston County enjoys the highest per capita income rate in Michigan, that means many social programs cost more here, and that puts them out of reach for families not living in the upper strata. Mike Hubert is the superintendent of the Livingston Educational Service Agency. He says less than half of Livingston students enter kindergarten after attending a high-quality preschool.
They're not going to grow, if they're from a position of poverty, as much and as quickly to catch up with their peers, because their peers are accelerating their learning. Our schools right now just don't give enough support to the students to fully catch up with their peers.
Urban school districts face much of the same. In Ingham County, 54% of 3- and 4-year-olds are not in preschool. That's higher than the statewide average. In Lansing, school officials are trying to blend Great Start, Head Start, and early special ed classes under one plan, a move that's designed to give kids in all three programs the highest possible level of support. The district is also poised to roll out a new core reading program, a change that Lansing Deputy Superintendent Mark Coscarella says is long overdue.
The last time Lansing could afford to purchase a core reading program was back in 2006. We know we've learned a lot more about how to teach reading. We know that the standards have changed and assessments have changed since that time. And yet our kids are still forced to work with a curriculum that's not current and modern.
That new curriculum may be a breath of fresh air for frustrated teachers struggling to stem a downhill slide. Friday afternoon at Riddle Elementary in Lansing, a stream of giddy kids pours out the door. Since 2015, Riddle has seen its third grade English language arts proficiency scores drop from 41 to 14%. Nicole Beard taught school for 17 years. Now she feels the pressure at the principal's desk.
Every administrator experiences this. They kind of hold their breath when they see that percentage before them, and they always hope, oh Lord, please don't let it drop again.
Beard doesn't shy away from the statistics, but she knows it only tells part of the story. Her kids' success in the classroom is largely shaped by their lives outside of it, and Beard has seen her share of trauma.
I can see when a child walks through the door, come on, let's talk. What's going on? There are many factors that our children may never tell us that they deal with. If we're going to be effective, if we're going to increase that percentage that we are judged by, that's the work that has to take place that people don't talk about.
The Lansing School Board is set to vote to adopt the new core reading program on May 3rd. But a more immediate concern for the district and hundreds of others is guiding their students through a key annual benchmark, the 4-week administration of the Michigan Student Test of Educational Progress, or MSTEP, begins April 30th. For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Look for Kevin's reports on Michigan schools and the deep challenges our state faces when it comes to literacy every Tuesday on Morning Edition, 5 to 9 a.m. on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Our next two stories are about the trials of fitting in at Michigan's two largest public universities. First, NPR All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro talked with a University of Michigan student helping fellow Wolverines in Ann Arbor with affordability.
College is expensive, and at the University of Michigan, the student government tried to help by publishing a guide for cost-effective living at the school. Some of the suggestions were not helpful.
You know, do you have a gardener that takes care of your house? Do you have a laundry service? Do you get your hair done every week? Do you get your nails done every week? These are things you can cut out of your life. Yeah, I'm going to go cut out my lawn service that I don't have already.
That's Michigan junior Griffin St. Ange, who decided with her friend to take matters into her own hands. They published an online guide that anybody can edit. It's now grown to 80 pages, and it's called Being Not Rich at UM.
I didn't really realize the culture of Michigan before coming here. I had been warned about it a little bit, but I had never met the kind of wealth that some of the students have here by the time that I came to university. So I remember my freshman orientation. They do this mandatory presentation, and it's about like 45 minutes. They go pretty in-depth about work-study opportunities and scholarships and loans and things like that. And I had been like trying to make friends a little bit earlier. I'd met this girl out of state. We were sitting and watching this presentation together. And I was sitting there starting to get a little worried, like, you know, this is such a big financial decision. My parents are helping the best they can. I've got scholarships and loans and a job and things like that. And this girl just turns to me and is like, gosh, I'm so bored. Like, my mom is going to pay for this anyway. I don't even need to be here. So that was kind of where I first realized, like, oh my gosh, like, you know, like, this is a really different culture than what I'm accustomed to. And like, some people here don't struggle with the same things that I struggle with.
So what made you realize that you could actually help your fellow students by working with your friends to write something like this that would be widely available, shareable, people could collectively edit it? What made you decide to take that plunge?
So my friend Lauren Shandoval came up with the idea. In the couple of days surrounding the guide, it was kind of becoming a joke, but also kind of becoming, you know, a serious conversation of like what this university looks like and how the student conversation of affordability kind of takes place. And she came up with the idea to start our own guide. So she kind of wrote up this like skeletal 10 to 15 phrases of like a table of contents. And then I heard about it pretty immediately and thought it was just such a great idea. And that, you know, as a junior in college, I had a lot of really useful information about, you know, work study and scholarships and things like that. So I really wanted to contribute.
Obviously, there's useful information in this guide. Is there more to it than that? Something about people being able to speak openly about things that in the past might have caused them shame that they might not have felt comfortable talking about?
So there's a lot of just like lists of like resources that the university already had, but then the structure of it has also been great because it's been a very trustworthy resource for people to talk candidly about their own experiences, I think. You know, they can say like, this job was really helpful to me, or this place sells, you know, day-old bread that's really cheap and things like that. There was also just a lot of like great sections about like making friends, because sometimes it can be hard when you're meeting like a lot of really wealthy students and they go to vacation in Europe for spring break and things like that, and you want to like do things with them, but they want to eat out all the time, and like, how do you navigate that? And we have a great section where it's just kind of like, you know, you're not alone. You know, you can be frank about the things that you're able to do and the things that you're not able to do.
Why do you think it's been so hard up until now to have this conversation about the economic divide among students?
The University of Michigan in particular does have resources for low-income students, but it's just so hard to market to students when they're coming from environments where if you were working a part-time job and taking care of your siblings instead of being captain of the swim team, how does that affect your application? There's a lot of really pressing issues on campus where the marginalization is very visible. Class can be less visible. So in particular with class, it's good to like have the guide, I think, because, you know, students can independently go and like comment resources they know regardless of what the definition they think of their socioeconomics status is. If they know something helpful, they can talk about it. And then from there, you know, we were able to kind of have a space for students to, you know, work together and talk about these issues and then also like implement the things that they think should be implemented.
Griffin St. Ange, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
She's a junior at University of Michigan, and she's one of the publishers of the new guide, Being Not Rich at UM.
Now, back to East Lansing. The mission of Rising Black Men is to empower African-American freshmen to find their way socially and academically at Michigan State University. Some of the group's members talked with current sports host Al Martin.
And the president is actually Tim Hurd, who is a junior at Michigan State majoring in education. Along with Tim, we have members Devin Hurd and Kareem Rasul. Fellas, how you guys doing? Welcome to Current Sports.
Pretty good. Thank you. Appreciate you for having us.
Always, man. So I'll start with you, Tim, because you're the founder. When did the idea pop in your head that you know what? We need to have a greater presence in helping young African-American males who come here to Michigan State University. How did this whole thing come about?
Yeah, so this organization came about last year, or actually this past summer, when I was up here during Summer Research Opportunity Program. And it was based around my research on closing the opportunity gap for black males in K-12 education. And I saw a lot of adverse effects specifically for black males as they transition towards a university, not just a predominantly white institute, but maybe a historically black college or a community college as well. One of those things was like a lack of expectations and deficit mindsets, but specifically transitioning to a predominantly white institute. There's like this lack of sense of community that a student might feel, specifically with the demographics I'm trying to reach, which is Detroit, which is predominantly black. Mm-hmm. So coming to a university that's predominantly white, there might be some type of culture shock. So kind of finding a way to limit that culture shock, finding solutions in terms of bridging that gap and bringing that support system so that there isn't a lack of sense of belonging, because that leads to lack of retention rates, both academically because they don't feel like they're supposed to be here, and then socially because they don't feel like they belong.
Devin, what was your experience when you came here to Michigan State University, your first year?
I don't think I really had a culture shock. I've had some opportunities to be at different institutions prior to coming here, you know, full time. But as soon as I got here, I met Tim. Like within the first few weeks, I met him at a midnight golf program. I didn't feel out of place. I don't think I had a chance to feel out of place yet. But I think that what we do with our meetings every week and our events every month really kind of gives us a sense of familiarity.
Right.
I think that has helped me, you know, as it relates to being confident and succeeding and, you know, and being able to feel like I have a place here.
It's fantastic. And Kareem, what was your experience when you first walked on this campus at Michigan State University? What was your experience like? Did you feel out of place?
I think for me, well, I was also kind of familiar with how it would be. I was in a program called Gear Up, mm-hmm. and this program would bring us to Michigan State's campus once a month. So that gave me time to really get familiar to how it would be on campus and like the feel of everything. But I also met Tim within the first few weeks, and that was a great like foundation, mm-hmm.
Like a family, right?
Right. Like a brotherhood, and that's been really essential with just the transition into college.
How would you describe, Tim, the racial dynamic here at Michigan State University? Is mm-hmm. it a healthy one?
Mm-hmm. So I would honestly say for me, the racial dynamic has been more so a healthy one for me. Just because of like the support that I've received across all races. And that was something that I didn't really have too many expectations coming here, creating my organization without, besides just impacting the young black males I came into contact with. But the other students who are both white and other people of color who kind of helped assist in the faculty, non-black faculty as well, who've kind of helped assist in the organization, they've definitely helped. So I would say for specifically within the confines of my organization, the racial dynamic has been a positive one. It's been a productive one, and it's been one conducive to just progression.
That's great to hear. What about for you, Devin? How would you describe what it's like walking around here with it's because Michigan State really is a melting pot. It really is. Yeah. Well, how would you describe the racial dynamic here at MSU?
The black community here at Michigan State, I think, other than any PWI, has a good way of sticking together. Mm-hmm. We have our own little community. You know how there's a black,
I know.
There's
Trust
a black
me.
Twitter. There's also a black MSU, and right, right. like. There's so many events, you know, I mean, we have the frats, the sororities, mm-hmm. we have all these organizations where we are able to actually seem like we have our own community within this one. And I think that we are doing a good job at supporting one another. You know, because of him, I know so many other people who are doing businesses, mm-hmm. little small little hustles, and it's going to grow into huge things. You can already see because everybody has a dream. Everybody has a lot of potential. Right. And I think that once we learn how to stick together and actually encourage one another, all those things is going to happen. And that's why I'm really happy to be a part of this organization.
Eating gluten-free has become one of the most popular diet trends of the past few years.
And that has boosted this relatively new gluten-free craze.
But is it right for you? Our Serving Up Science team will discuss coming up next. Also, Me Too meets STEM. Women in the Great Lakes share their stories of gender bias in science, technology, engineering, and math fields. When Current State on WKAR continues.
Food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science. Welcome to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and planet. I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And I'm Karel Vega. Today's topic is about a fairly new food trend that's been picking up steam for several years now. Advocates of this trend claim it makes them feel better.
I can tell a difference myself when I eat gluten. When grains aren't sprouted, I feel fatigued, lack of energy.
Well, if you're used to eating these types of foods, especially high processed foods like cereals and crackers, you are going to have a hard time detoxifying from gluten.
It helps you with your energy. It helps avoid insulin spikes because we're not eating a lot of processed starches and sugars.
But does it actually? I'm talking, of course, about the gluten-free craze.
Karel, I was at my favorite coffee shop in Lansing today, and I really wanted a muffin, but they only offered gluten-free options.
By the way you said that, I'm assuming that you didn't get one?
I didn't get one. I got a donut, but I really wanted a muffin. Have you noticed that the gluten-free craze seems to be taking over everywhere?
Yeah, you see it everywhere these days, but I haven't really thought too much about it. Is it actually any healthier?
Nope. Well, not exactly. So if you're among the maybe 1% of the population that has celiac disease, you should avoid gluten. And there's new research that suggests the incidence may be increasing.
Tell me a little bit more about celiac disease.
Celiac disease is an autoimmune condition that attacks the intestines and other tissues when you eat gluten. So it leads to stomach aches, bloating, GI problems, chronic fatigue, anemia, weight loss, all sorts of issues that none of us really want to deal with.
That sounds really similar to something like irritable bowel syndrome.
It can be. Some of the symptoms of celiac disease are the same as IBS, but that's part of the reason millions of Americans are self-diagnosing as having celiac disease and only buying gluten-free products. And also, doctors suspect that a lot of people who actually do have celiac disease don't know it.
Because they might not have access to information about it, or maybe they don't see their doctor regularly?
Exactly.
So, more gluten-free options at the grocery store and on menus for the small percentage of those people who have celiac disease, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. The thing is that companies are marketing this gluten-free label as if it has some kind of health benefit for all of us, and it doesn't.
I guess I do notice the gluten-free label a lot. Where can we find gluten?
Gluten is a protein. It's in wheat and barley and rye. It makes up a lot of the things that we eat.
So like pasta, breads, cereals?
Yep, things we have every single day.
Is there a reason to avoid gluten if you don't have celiac disease?
Typically, no. There are people who say they're gluten sensitive and they just simply feel better if they cut gluten out of their diet.
Do they actually?
Sure, if they say so, why not?
Okay, so Cheryl, does it matter if the rest of us are eating gluten-free foods?
Not exactly, but if you don't have a medical condition, gluten-free foods aren't usually any healthier. And in fact, those products labeled as gluten-free are frequently higher in the things they're substituting for gluten. So they might have more salt or fat or sugar, or at least they can. And they also tend to be more expensive.
You're saying gluten-free options are unhealthier than conventional foods?
Not necessarily unhealthier, but some can be. It's really a case-by-case basis. But if they have more salt, say, and you have a problem with high blood pressure, you might run into some issues.
So going gluten-free isn't exactly like being a vegetarian or avoiding saturated fats.
Right. It only conveys a benefit to someone with a specific condition. The rest is really all about clever marketing, and that has boosted this relatively new gluten-free craze.
Let's talk about an interesting marketing tactic for a second. A lot of these foods that are being marketed as gluten-free have actually been gluten-free the whole time.
It's true. So think about some cereals made from corn. They can put a big gluten-free label on the box, and they haven't really changed anything at all.
For the people that have celiac disease and avoiding gluten is a good thing, that's great. But for the people that are just doing it for the sake of it, do you see this trend going away anytime soon?
Definitely not. I think once we buy into a certain style of eating, it takes a lot for us to change our minds about it. And so I expect we'll be seeing gluten-free options at the supermarket and in restaurants and in coffee shops for quite some time.
So in a nutshell, Cheryl, what's the deal with gluten-free foods?
Well, if you need to avoid gluten, they're great. But if you don't have celiac disease and if you don't think you have a gluten sensitivity, it's probably not worth the investment and the hit your wallet might take. And it also might not be so good for you if it has a lot of salt and sugar and fat in it.
You've been listening to Serving Up Science, the series all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and our planet. Next week on Serving Up Science, impossible foods. New breakthroughs in science are allowing us to make meat and cheese out of plants, but get this, the meat bleeds. This ain't your parents' veggie burger.
If you have something you want to add to the conversation about gluten or going gluten-free, let us know by commenting on the Serving Up Science page on WKAR.org.
Until next time, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And this is WKAR.
Thank you, Karel and Cheryl. And you can hear fresh episodes of Serving Up Science every Wednesday afternoon at 4:45 and 6:45 during All Things Considered on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. The STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, have traditionally been dominated by men. That can make it tough for women to break in or gain respect. Now, the Me Too movement is highlighting those issues, and some female professionals in the Great Lakes region have their own stories about the culture of gender bias. Angelica Morrison from our reporting partner Great Lakes Today explains.
The Great Lakes Center Field Station, which is just a few miles away from the Buffalo State campus.
They're somehow affected.
Inside the Great Lakes Center Field Station, which is just a few miles away from the Buffalo State campus, Alicia Perez Fuente Taha checks on a collection of tiny pet fish.
What are they? Are those pet shiners?
Yeah, well, that's a spot pail shiner.
The field station is where some of her research takes place. She's an aquatic ecologist known for her work with emerald shiners and the detection of antidepressants in the brains of fish from the Niagara River. She says as a woman, building a career in the sciences isn't easy.
When females around in the field would get pregnant or got married, the comments from the fellow males would be like, poof, she's out of the game now, or she's having kids, you can count on her now. Sort of like being a mother somehow affected your ability to do your work. And those comments are common, and sometimes they're pretty harsh.
Perez Fuente Taha says change begins to happen when women learn to speak up.
Another hurdle for women: if you're doing very well, a man would go speak to your dean and ask for a raise. A woman will not. Or if they ask for a raise, it's for a little tiny raise, not a big one, right?
In a recent survey of female STEM professionals who work in predominantly male environments, 78% say they've experienced discrimination. In that same Pew Research Group survey, close to 50% say they've experienced sexual harassment or their gender has made it hard for them to succeed in their field. Monica Deuce knows that feeling well. She's an assistant professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at the University of Michigan. Back in her undergraduate years about a decade ago, she recalls a day when she was sent home because she was wearing pink boots. It was during a science program where she was showing high school students various experiments.
It was 8:30 a.m. and I was told I had to go change my pink shoes because it wasn't professional for a scientist to wear pink.
Unfortunately, the problems didn't stop with the color of her shoes. Now she's uncomfortable repeating some of the things said to her over the years, but there's one experience she did share.
I was quite thin, and one of the male graduate students asked me if I got my periods because I was so thin.
University at Buffalo engineering professor Liesl Folks is working to combat some of these issues. She's leading a program aimed at giving students the tools to deal with gender bias. Right now, she's starting a session with a group of about 20 students.
a lot of time to think and reflect on what you learned at the retreat and are all sort of energized for what we're going to learn today at the workshop.
She says all too often women in STEM choose to abandon their careers because of gender-based conflicts at work.
So what we see is it's very, very, very common for women when they hit these barriers to take that first step. They will usually take some kind of an action.
And the first step is to tell management or human resources.
If it turns out badly and that first action doesn't result in a positive change in their working environment, then often what they do is just go back to their office and say, I'm just going to avoid the situation, I'm going to work harder than I ever did, I'm going to do better work, and I will be recognized for my better work, and I'm just going to try and stay out of the way of whatever else is going on that's negative. But that ends up being soul-destroying.
Some of the skills she teaches in the program include forming alliances with coworkers. This will help provide support if something should happen. Also, before jumping ship, female STEM professionals should clearly evaluate all of their options. This is Angelica Morrison.
You can take in some great music and watch a nationally televised show being recorded without leaving our area. Forget The Voice or American Idol. Come join us here at WKAR Studios starting April 30th as we record the next season of Backstage Pass. And joining me now to talk about it is Julie Soche, Content and Community Engagement Manager here at WKAR. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you, Reginald. Thanks for having me.
This sounds like so much fun. So tell us a little bit about Backstage Pass. Where is it recorded and where is it shown?
Well, Backstage Pass is one of WKAR-TV's original programs. It features a wide variety of music, many genres, a live audience, and interviews, backstage interviews with the musicians. If you are a musical arts lover, this series is definitely one you should check out. Backstage Pass, the program, is aired locally here on WKAR-TV as well as nationally in over 70 markets in the U.S.,
Julie, say if I want to come to one of these concerts, what do we need to do and how can people attend?
Well, these concerts, the Backstage Pass concerts, are recorded right here at the WKAR-TV studios at Michigan State. And if you're interested in attending, you can pre-reserve your seat now for any of the shows at WKAR.org. We will also have some standby seating each night. So if you aren't able to pre-reserve at the website, you can come to show up that night. Doors open at 6:30 and the concert begins at 7.
Now to the music. Let's start with Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers. Let's hear a little from them.
I ain't got no money, spent it on a jet ski. Living it dark, everybody loves me. I ain't homeless, but not thinking you.
Julie, tell me a little bit more about Joe Hertler and the Rainbow Seekers.
Well, Joe Hertler himself is a Lansing local, so he's right here in our area. Joe, along with his Rainbow Seekers, features upbeat, groovy rock, and they're also known for their unexpected and exciting live performances.
Then on Tuesday night, May 1st, it's the Harma Lees.
The Harma Lees are an amazing duo, and they bring a craft poetic, is what they would describe it, passionate and powerful sound. Their music itself combines indie, folk, pop, and Americana, so a lot of different genres there, but it's a beautiful sound.
And that's music from the band that will play on Wednesday night, Jesse Ray and the Carolina Catfish.
Well, Jesse Ray and the Carolina Catfish are actually from Grand Rapids. Their sound is a rockabilly influenced, infused with blues, punk, and rock and roll with a small dash of country.
And Friday night, the final act, Sisters of Your Sunshine Vapor, another fun name.
Well, their sound is a little bit more on the sublime, hypnotic, and spacey feel. A lot of their music was inspired by a near-death experience after a flight they all were on for a tour.
Can you hear me at the side of the road? One last, too many gone.
We've been listening to Julie Soche, Content and Community Engagement Manager here at WKAR. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Reginald.
And Julie was telling me about all the bands you can watch for free at WKAR Studios all next week while we tape for the nationally distributed Backstage Pass show. Find out all the times and directions on WKAR.org or go to the WKAR Facebook page. That's it for this edition of Current State. For the entire WKAR news team, I'm Reginald Hardwick. We'll connect with you next weekend. We leave you with Linkin Park native Bob Seger celebrating a birthday on May 6th.
Stood there boldly, sweating in the sun. Felt like a million, felt like number one. The height of summer, I'd never felt that strong, like a rock. I was 18, didn't have a care, working for peanuts, not a dime to spare. But I was leaning solid everywhere, like a rock. My hands were steady, my eyes were clear and bright. My walk had purpose, my steps were quick and light, and I held firm to what I felt was right, like a rock, like a rock. I was strong as I could be.